Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does it feel when you're prepared to sacrifice your own life to protect a president only to see him gunned down in cold blood? While the nightmare of the Kennedy assassination touched virtually every American alive to remember what happened, the men assigned to protect the president's life have a unique perspective on the day that shots rang out from the Texas School Book Depository. Now, 47 years later, they are sharing their memories with the world. Clint Hill is a former Secret Service agent whose duties included protection of Jacqueline Kennedy, President Lyndon Baines Johnson, and Nixon Vice President Spiro Agnew. Gerald Blaine is a former Secret Service agent assigned to protect Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, and Johnson. Lisa McCubbin is a journalist who, along with Blaine, is the author of The Kennedy Detail, JFK's Secret Service Agents Break Their Silence. All three will appear at a book signing event Saturday, November 20th at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. It begins at 3. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Jerry, I want to start with you. What made you decide after all these years to put all this into a book?
Well, we wanted to set the record straight. Unfortunately, history was going to be measured by what I call a cottage industry of conspiracy theory. And so much of it was distorted. We read stories about agents on our detail being part of a conspiracy, of agents shooting the president, one on purpose, the other one accidentally. We decided it was time to speak up.
So, did that hurt or did it just make you angry?
Well, it hurt. We never discussed the assassination with each other. Mm-hmm. And we all went about our lives. We had no trauma counseling. We just had to work with that on our own. So as time went by, when this started coming out, I started contacting the agents. And so the Kennedy detail is the result of that.
Clint, anyone who has seen the Zapruder film has seen your picture because you were the agent who was climbing back onto the limousine to get Mrs. Kennedy down. Can you talk about, you had not cooperated with a lot of other efforts. People would want to talk to you. What made you decide to work with Jerry and Lisa and do this book?
Well, I've known Jerry since 1959, so I trusted him. Mm-hmm. When he called me about the book, I was very apprehensive. I'd had many offers to write a book or contribute to books, but I'd turned them all down. He promised that he would write a book that was not salacious, not full of gossip, and that was factual. And so I told him that I would contribute, provided I could check the book, make sure it was factual, before I went to the publisher. And he agreed to do that, so I agreed to contribute.
Lisa, can you talk about the fact-checking in a work like this where there are public records, there are people who have personal memories? Sometimes they must conflict, and other times they're the same. How do you work through that?
Yes, that definitely came into play. There is a lot on the public record. We used a lot of what are called shift reports that are in the public record now that the agents filled out, and it says where they were every minute of every day and who was assigned to what. So when their memories didn't seem to jive, we would go to this shift reports and say, try to figure out, well, who was on the shift with you at this time? And then that would help the memories and vice versa. So we did do a lot of fact checking. I watched a lot of videos to kind of visualize for myself because I wasn't born when the assassination occurred. So I didn't live through the events and I really had to educate myself on this as well.
I want to talk about, if there's one thing I learned from this, it's that there was no such thing as a typical day for someone on the Kennedy detail. You guys were traveling a lot. Can you both maybe talk a little bit about what the work entails?
Well, we were pre-technology. We had neither the technology nor the manpower. There were 34 agents on the Kennedy detail, and Clint and the children had a total of 5 agents looking after that.
At $1.80 an hour, excuse me.
At $1.80 an hour, we averaged 60 hours a month overtime. We had 3x5 photo flashcards that we carried of potential threats, so we memorized those photos, and everybody always wondered why we wore sunglasses. And it was to hide our eyes, because if we were going along the motorcade route and we noticed one of those on the profile, we'd just follow the eyes, and if we discerned any problem, we could motion by hand signals. We had no radios. Mm-hmm. So that was our life. But we loved our job. We were 1,000% dedicated to it.
There are a lot of really wonderful stories in the book of the relationships that formed. And in particular, Clint, you really got to be close to Mrs. Kennedy.
We were very close, but it was a very professional relationship. She mm-hmm. always called me Mr. Hill. I always called her Mrs. Kennedy. But we were very close. Most people don't know that she was a closet smoker, and I was her enabler. We'd go someplace, and if we were going out to Middleburg, for example, she'd stop the car, and I'd get in the back with her, and the driver would carry on, and she'd ask me for a cigarette, and I'd light it for her, and she'd smoke. But if we were in a crowd, in an area where there might be people, if she was going to smoke, as soon as anybody showed up, the cigarette immediately was in my hand, and I became the smoker. A lot of things like that. I had two boys who were similar age to John and Caroline, and she wanted me to bring my boys over to play with John and Caroline. And I had a very difficult time convincing her that was a bad idea. I could just see one of my boys causing a problem for one of her children, and I'd end up in Muddy Gap, Wyoming for sure.
Talk for a minute, Lisa, about the decision to have these kinds of stories in addition to the hard and fast details of November 23rd.
Well, what I really loved about this story was just the human aspect of it. So many people see these Secret Service agents and see them in their dark suits and their sunglasses, and I called them the nameless, faceless men, and I wanted people to know them as men and to understand that they did have families and children of their own. And when the assassination occurred, you know, they're human beings and how it affected each and every one of them. So to show these relationships that they had with the Kennedy family, to show the relationships they had with their wives and their kids once they left the White House and went back to their little two-bedroom apartments, and sort of, you know, that strange living sort of two separate lives, mm-hmm. I thought was really fascinating, and I thought other people would find that interesting as well.
Jerry, the president, during the time that the underground nuclear fallout shelter was being constructed at the White House, sort of took you aside and wanted to make sure you understood that if something were to happen, God forbid, you would be down there with him, and your wife and your kids would be out in the world.
Yes, I was with him the night that he spoke to the nation, and we went down to the Situation Room afterwards, and we got in the elevator, and he turned to me and said, you know, we're in a bit of a pickle. He said, you've got to join me if we evacuate, and your wife will be at home. And how do you feel about that? And I just said, well, that's our job.
It does seem like a tough job to have had and also maintained any kind of human relationships outside of the office.
Yes. Uh-huh. Well, we never spoke to our wives or our family or any associates that weren't connected to the Secret Service detail. So it was our wives, families, and friends just operated in silence. So it...
So let's talk about the trip to Texas. Were there any particular threats that you were briefed on, that you were aware of, specific to Dallas?
Well, let me take that. When I went to Protective Research Section, we had a nationwide list of 10 names. Ironically, the top name was a gatecrasher. So, but down at the bottom of the list, the last two were threats in Tampa, Florida. And one was a young man who was going through psychiatric problems. His family agreed to make sure he stayed at home, and we had an agent maintain surveillance. The second one was already in jail for threatening the mayor. So those threats were out. But I checked the entire file for anybody in the region, and there were no threats whatsoever in Dallas. So coming to Texas, it was like any other trip.
And Lee Harvey Oswald's name was not on that list.
We had no knowledge of Lee Harvey Oswald.
So when you're in a crowd situation like the motorcade and like the crowds that I guess the president really welcomed in many of the places that he went, what are the special challenges to allowing him to have the contact that he really demanded of you with the people that were there to see him, and also making sure that you keep people at a safe distance?
Well, he really liked to get into a crowd because he wanted to be among the electorate. They're the people that put him in office, and that was what we all understood. But it made things more difficult for us, of course. We simply watched the crowd, the movement in the crowd, how people reacted to him, facial expressions, various things that people do. We received training at a facility in Washington, D.C., where the psychologists and psychiatrists worked with us and helped us understand what we should be looking for. And that's about the way we operated in a very crowded situation, which was almost on a daily basis.
Was that a source of tension between—I mean, obviously he's the boss, and which is what you referred to him as when you were not in his presence. But was it something that senior members of the Secret Service tried to push back against a little bit?
Well, we tried, but we recognize that in a free society, he's going to have access to the people. We'd love to have him sitting out in front of the White House in a glass box, and he can facilitate the whatever job he wanted to do in that manner. But he has to be out among the electorate. And so we just tried to devise methods and procedures to accommodate that type of activity. It was much different than what we previously – I was with President Eisenhower, and that was not his normal method of operation. So this was new and different to us, but we tried to develop various procedures to accommodate that.
Well, Clint Hill, you say glass box. There's been so much talk over the years about the bubble top that could have been attached to the limousine. First of all, was this bulletproof or was it rainproof?
It was rainproof, probably. It was not bulletproof. No, nothing on that particular car. We called it 100X. Nothing on that car was bulletproof at all. And the only time that top was ever used on the car was if it were raining or if there were a situation where Mrs. Kennedy was with the president and they wanted to make sure she didn't get her hair messed up.
So,
other than that, when he rode in that car, it was in a parade situation, motorcade usually, and it was always open.
How was the route determined, Jerry?
Well, the route was determined basically based upon where the luncheon would be held. And when they decided to hold the luncheon where they did, the only route possible was to take the route that they did, which was to cut onto Houston down to Elm. And a lot of people speculate he could have gone straight, but there's a barrier there. Most people who write these theories forget to look at the geography and realize there was only one route.
And what did you think about the Trademark as a site?
The Trademark was ideally what the president would like. Mm-hmm. It was new. It was, they took the alternative at the state fairgrounds.
Right.
It really wasn't presidential, I guess. And the decision was made. We had political advanced people and the White House and so forth. So there was no problem. It took a lot of people to protect that particular venue, but there was nothing unusual about it. And Win Lawson, the advance agent, picked the right route.
My guests this hour are Gerald Blaine, former Secret Service agent, and former agent Clint Hill. Both were members of the Kennedy Detail. Also here is journalist Lisa McCubbin, who, along with Mr. Blaine, wrote the book The Kennedy Detail, JFK's Secret Service Agents Break Their Silence. They're in town for a book signing event that will take place at 3 on Saturday at the 6th Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are former Secret Service agent Clint Hill, former Secret Service agent Gerald Blaine, and journalist Lisa McCubbin. They are all in town for an event taking place on Saturday at the 6th Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. First, at 2 o'clock, they will be talking about the new book, The Kennedy Detail, JFK's Secret Service Agents Break Their Silence. That talk is filled to capacity. However, you can meet them an hour later at 3 when there is a book signing event if you'd like to be there. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Clint, can you talk about what you remember about the way your body felt when you heard the first shot?
Well, I just simply reacted and tried to propel myself off the car that I was on, which was immediately behind the presidential vehicle, forward toward the presidential vehicle. It was just kind of an automatic reaction type of thing. I ran as fast as I could. Obviously, it wasn't fast enough. But when I just before I got to the presidential vehicle, the fatal shot hit the president. And so I was just a little bit too late.
And at that point, I guess you said you just reacted. There's no time to think, oh, my God, what is this, right? You have to put that aside?
There's no thought at all. It's just strictly a reaction thing. And a lot of the training we had previously helped me react in that manner. So as soon as I heard that first shot, I did react and left the car. I was the only agent in a position to do anything. Everybody else's position was wrong to react to this particular event because I had been scanning left. When I scanned back to the right, I saw the president react to the first shot. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was scanning back to the right. Their eyes went away from the car, so they didn't realize that the president had been hit at first.
So you're in the car the entire ride to Parkland Hospital?
Over on top of the back of the car. I spread-eagled as much as I could at top of the back of the car. I got up as high as I could so to prevent anybody from shooting back into the car and hitting any of the occupants, both the president, Mrs. Kennedy, and Governor, Mrs. Connolly. I didn't know the governor had been hit until we were about halfway to Parkland, and he moved slightly, and I could see the cover front of his chest and shirt area was completely covered in blood. So then I realized that he also had been hit.
And the president and his wife in particular, they're people that you've come to know pretty intimately. These are also people you care about in crisis. I mean, is training enough to not have that ringing through your consciousness?
Well, it may ring through your consciousness, but you can't let your emotions take over because you have a job to do. In my case, my job was to make sure we could evacuate them as quickly and I could cover as much as I could so that nobody else could do any damage to them. And that's exactly what we did. But you just have to put your emotions aside and continue on with your job.
Jerry, talk about how you found out what had happened. Talk about how you found out what had taken place.
Well, I had returned after I completed the events in Tampa. I was on a midnight shift, and we were with the president from midnight till morning in Fort Worth and flew to Austin. And I had been in bed about 5 minutes when there was a pounding on the door, and our shift leader told us that the president had been shot. We immediately went out to the local Air Force base and caught a tanker to fly back to Washington, D.C. There was not a word that passed between any of the agents on board. And when we arrived in Andrews Air Force Base, we found out the president was dead. So it was a terrible shock.
So you're there in Washington, and your first next assignment is to guard the new president.
Well, I was to go and work midnights that night at the Elms, which is a vice presidential residence, and that's what I did.
And this was a harrowing night for you.
Yes. I assume you're talking about the near accident I had with President Johnson.
If you don't
Johnson.
Mind talking about it, yeah.
No. It was President Johnson, as vice president, had two agents with him. So there was no particular routine, you know, two agents at any one time. With President Kennedy, we had, normally we had about five agents on duty. And if the president decided to leave his residence, he would notify us. And then word would go around, and he would go around the house in a particular way. This is outside the White House. Mm-hmm. So we didn't know whether it was a conspiracy or what at that time. So I heard a noise coming around. I hadn't slept in 40 hours. I was close to hallucinating, and I heard the noise, picked up a Thompson submachine gun and cranked one into the chamber to activate it, and put the gun to my shoulder, and around the corner came the new president of the United States. He stopped in his tracks, didn't say a word to me, turned around and went inside. I unloaded a gun and put it as far away from me as I possibly could.
Lisa, this is not a story that has been told before, this book. Is that correct?
Right. It's never been published before.
What did you think when you heard it?
Well, it was one of the first stories I think Jerry told me, as we started working on the book. One of the things I asked him immediately is, "What's new? You know, what are we going to write about in this book that's new?" Because I knew that's what the publishers and news media, everybody was going to ask.
Yeah.
And so this was one of the stories that he told me. And I mean, it's kind of funny looking back on it, you know, and the way he described it. But I could just feel the tension that must have been there at the time. And also then to think about if he had killed the president, I mean, it would have just been, how tragic would that have been, and how the world events would have changed even further.
You mentioned earlier, Jerry, that there was no post-traumatic counseling for the people who were involved in this or who were on the detail. You guys basically had to get right back to work. But you were told, you were both instructed not to say certain things about the president's desire for space. Can you address that?
Okay. That involved an incident that occurred in Tampa. And we were so shorthanded, we were down to the bottom of the shift, and we had a 28-mile motorcade. And so we didn't wear the agents out. I said, "Well, why don't you ride on the back end of the presidential limousine?" And I checked it out with superiors, and they gave the okay, didn't know how the president would accept it. Well, along the route, he turned around, and he noticed the two standing back there. And I was riding in a lead car. The next thing I knew was a radio transmission stating that the president wanted the Ivy League charlatans to withdraw to the follow-up car. I didn't know what a charlatan was, so I wrote it down. And it sure wouldn't have come from Floyd Boring, who was doing it. Well, afterwards, what he indicated, and, you know, you have to look at what he was elected for, you know, to make some changes in society. One of those was civil rights, a very controversial issue at that time. And he knew that his political style, he had to have access to the people. And so he requested that we lay back on that. And that was a request that went down. Now, after the assassination, the chief of the Secret Service called us in and he said, "You know, we can't say that the president asked for his own death. So I would like you to pass the word around. Let's shut up about this." And we did. I thought it was an excellent decision on the part of the chief. So
it certainly must have been a self-sacrificing move, given that you have this knowledge and then it's going to look like.
I think it went through everybody's head afterwards, you know, especially when things turned out. Would it have been different? But the reality was, and Clint can confirm this, when we went down Elm Street, we would not have had agents on the car anyway, because there were not crowds going down Elm Street, and we were entering into a freeway, and the speeds pick up there, and there's no sense in having agents on the back of the car.
That's correct. We wouldn't have been there in under any circumstances, because, like Jerry said, we were just about to hit a freeway. We don't want the agents up there on a freeway at freeway speeds. And the crowd had completely dissipated almost so that there wouldn't have been any requirement for the agents to be back there.
Can you talk about, did you both feel a sense of personal culpability having been on the detail and the essential mission has failed at this point?
Well, we hadn't. You know, guys who go on there have an awful lot of confidence in themselves. Mm-hmm. But I mention in the book the fact that there's a risk factor that goes into this. With President Eisenhower, who had not a narcissistic bone in his body, he rode in a covered car all the time, did not care if he ran into a crowd of people. We felt 95% confident. But the reality with Kennedy, with the resources we had, we always knew our vulnerabilities, and we felt we had a 70% chance of succeeding.
Did you worry about your careers at all after this?
Well, I wasn't worried too much about my career. I really felt a sense of guilt and personal responsibility because I was the only one who had a chance to do anything. No, none of the other guys did. I was then asked to stay with Mrs. Kennedy for another year, but I never really felt or was concerned about my career.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've got a comment leading to a question. You know, we could just forget about all the gossip because that stuff is debatable. My question is about historians like Doris Kearns Goodwin and others, whose job it is to create a portrait of these people that you protected. And my question is, how well did those people do? How are they at portraying the people that you knew? And at the core of this question is, how well do any of you guys know the people that you cover? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, we know the people we cover pretty well. We're with them from the moment they're elected till they're out of office, and that means 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We know when they get up, when they go to bed, and we try not to interfere with their personal life in the residence area in which they live, but we know pretty much everything that's going on. Regarding the historians, Doris Kearns Goodwin is probably one of the best, and insofar as I know, she's extremely accurate and very factual. And she spends a lot of time with these people if they're still living. Prior to writing anything, she's an extremely good historian.
Anything? Do you want to add anything to that?
No. Historians have different motives. All we know is the people that spent their time, the most time with the president, and the others that were isolated. And there were a lot of isolated people that wrote history. And, you know, you question some of the things that they assume that weren't true according to the personality of the people we were protecting.
Well, and Doris Kearns Goodwin, just so you know this, she's married to one of President Kennedy's assistants, Dick Goodwin. He was one of the assistants to President Kennedy, so she knew him quite well.
Yeah.
Lisa, how much did you have to feel at the end? Did you almost feel as if you'd been there, or are you always aware that this is a story that you're trying to interpret through the people who were there?
No, there was a point when I was working on this where I was sleeping, dreaming about it, waking up to it. I felt like I was living in 1963. And it's a very emotional story. So I, spent a lot of time talking to Clint, trying to draw things out of him, and then trying to get into his head to write about what it felt like going through this. And it was very emotional for me as well.
Was it difficult to not dwell on this, given that there's probably not been a day when there wasn't a headline somewhere that dealt with this particular terrible day in American history, but in your personal lives as well, your professional lives?
Well, in my personal life, it's been with me ever since the assassination occurred on a daily basis. Something always reminds me of President Kennedy or the Kennedy, Mrs. Kennedy or the children. And so I live with it continuously. It's gotten better over the years because it's because of time, but it's still there, and I still have the images of seeing him in the backseat of the car.
I left the Secret Service in 1964. I read the Warren Report, not only the report, but the 23 volumes. I was convinced and satisfied with the report that that came out. And then I went to see the movie JFK by Oliver Stone. He took every possible theory and threw it into one movie. I was disgusted when I walked away from it. And I said, well, that's the last that I read on conspiracy. I'm going to go about my professional career. And I had a interesting career. I had a lot of close calls. I saw a lot of bloody scenes. And I when I retired, there was one thing I could not get straight in my mind, and that was President Kennedy's assassination. Nor did I really know the inner impact that it had on me.
And I think this this book, really, what I've seen it be a real healing process for all of the agents who have been involved with it. You know, and I don't know that that was necessarily the intent, but it certainly has been a result, which has been really nice.
Has it struck all of you as sort of a generational thing? I think at least you and I are about the same age, and I think if it were our husbands, it would be something they would have to talk about. But it was sort of a different, clearly a different time and a different culture.
That was our 9/11, and the whole world turned upside down, and it evolved. We lived in sort of a utopia between 1945 and 54, even though we had the Korean War. And you could see our society changing. You know, immediately following the President Kennedy's assassination, within the years, we lost Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and Clinton mentioned there hasn't been a president in that didn't have a serious threat or an attempt. So our whole society changed.
My guests this hour are former Secret Service agents Gerald Blaine and Clint Hill and journalist Lisa McCubbin. Blaine and McCubbin are co-authors of The Kennedy Detail, JFK's Secret Service Agents Break Their Silence. All three will be at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza on Saturday, November 20th. There's a 2 p.m. address that is already full to capacity. However, you can meet them and get copies of the book at a book signing that takes place an hour later at 3 o'clock. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-533 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are former Secret Service agents Clint Hill and Gerald Blaine and journalist Lisa McCubbin. Blaine and McCubbin are co-authors of the new book, The Kennedy Detail, JFK's Secret Service Agents Break Their Silence. All three are in town for an event Saturday at the Sixth Floor Museum at Dealey Plaza. There's a talk that is full to capacity starting at 2. However, there's a book signing event and there is still space there that begins at 3 o'clock. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from David in Plano who writes, I used to live next door to a retired Secret Service agent. He was a perfect gentleman, and despite some of the unusual stories he told us about life in the service, not once did I hear him say anything negative about the conduct or actions of his colleagues. My question is, how do members of the Secret Service deal mentally with the outlandish accusations against you while still doing a job that requires the highest level of discretion and secrecy?
Well, it does no good to discuss the things that we do. We have a statement on the commission book that we're worthy of trust and confidence. And that means that the people we protect, their life is their own, and we do not discuss it. The only time we ever discuss anything is among each other. We don't discuss it with our families. We maintain a secret in it. It just, you have to have mental toughness to do it and deal with it.
You have to have mental toughness, but you must also have to have sensitivity, because whether you discuss something or not, you're present for a lot of moments that are pretty intimate, that most people don't have an outsider, even a friend, around to witness. And I wonder if you can talk about that balance of toughness and sensitivity.
Well, Clint will talk about his side, but I conducted the advance for the burial of Patrick, their son that died. And we were out at the cemetery, and I watched the president break down, and it, all the agents had tears in their eyes. It was a tragic moment, and Clint, you know, was with, I think he was the first one that found out she was pregnant, so...
Yeah, we had some very personal relationships, Mrs. Kennedy and I, regarding that type of thing. I was with her when John was born, was with her when Patrick was born, and was with her when Patrick died. And so I saw her very happy and exuberant, and I saw her extremely sad and very, very depressed because of what had happened. And I was also with her when her husband was killed. So I saw her react in that manner, also become extremely depressed and demoralized about what had happened. But we as the agents have to keep our emotions in check, and although we're witness to what goes on and privy to a lot of this information and a lot of things that happen, we just never really discuss it, even with our own families. And once in a while we may say something to each other in private, to another agent, but never outside the service.
Is there... is there any part of you now that this book has been written? And there's no salacious detail, so people looking for that can look elsewhere. But is there anything, once the book went to press, that any of the three of you thought, oh, God, now it's done, this thing that I've held off for so long?
Well, the one thing was the closeness of all of us. We were like brothers, you know. We laughed together. We cried together. I don't remember any hostility towards another agent, although we evaluated who came on the detail. But you're tense all day long when you're with the president. Your attention is strictly on protecting. And after the day is over, and the days are over sometimes at midnight, 1 in the morning, you just can't go to bed, you know. And so we had to unwind with each other. We were the only ones that we could talk about different things or bring a little frivolity to life. And so the relationship has just lasted over the years.
Well, that's it. We're like a bunch of brothers. Mm-hmm. We play together. They, like at Cape Cod, the various shifts created softball teams. There were Godfrey's Gorillas and Robert's Raiders and Stout's Scouts, and they play against each other. But we really kept to ourselves and stayed within the organization because we couldn't discuss things outside the organization itself.
It's interesting when you talk about playing softball and having frivolity in your off-duty moments, because I think a lot of people think of a Secret Service agent and they think of someone who is very humorless and committed to the job, certainly, but maybe they imagine a type of personality. Did that surprise you at all, Lisa?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that was really important to me to bring out in the book, is to bring out their various personalities and this frivolity. And they all seem to have a great sense of humor and would joke around with each other. And, I just wanted to show this sort of comradeship that they had, this band of brothers. And I think that does come out in the book. And we're very proud of that.
Let's go back to the phones now. And this time we'll speak with David in Fort Worth. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
My question was concerning the Texas Hotel the night before President Kennedy died.
In Fort Worth.
And if any events stood out that they could possibly talk about that's never been mentioned before.
Thank you for your call. I know that the connection was a little bad. David was asking about the hotel stay in Fort Worth the night before and if anything stands out to you.
I guess they're talking about the night before in Fort Worth. Well, being on the midnight shift, the Hotel Texas was a very stuffy hotel. And we would take post in about every... after a tour of an hour, after you covered the three shifts, we'd take a break and go outside and, get coffee. And we'd talk to the other agents we'd see and so forth. But I assume he's talking about the story about agents drinking the night before. Let Clint review what happened that day and give you a review of how the agents felt.
Sure. I was one of those agents. We left Washington around 10 that morning. It was on a Thursday. And we flew to San Antonio. We had a function in San Antonio, which involved motorcade both in and out. Flew to Houston and had to go to a big hotel in Houston for a couple of functions at that location, which required a motorcade in and out. Then we flew on to Fort Worth. We didn't get to Fort Worth until about 12:30 in the morning, 12:40 in the morning. Now, we hadn't eaten except for a very small snack on Air Force One. I guess it was just before we got to San Antonio. So we hadn't eaten all day, and we've been working all day. And as we were finishing up in Fort Worth, which was around 1 in the morning, one of the members of the press told us that there was a facility there called the Press Club at which they were going to have some food and beverages. And if we were hungry and wanted to get a sandwich or something, we were welcome to come over with them. So some of us decided to do just that. When we got there, there was no food. So I personally had a drink, bought a couple packs of cigarettes. We went to another place to see if they had any food. They did not. And so I went back to the hotel and went to bed. Got up at 6 in the morning and went back to work, had breakfast in the room. But other than that, there was nothing that happened that night, either in the Texas hotel or any place else that I'm aware of that was of any big problem.
This was thoroughly investigated. I spent a day reading all the material that was in the archives at College Park in Maryland and read the entire investigation on that. And it was, proven that there was nobody that was drunk and came out and verified that everything was okay. But I'm sure this contributed to the guilt of everybody, because just pointing out that somebody was doing that, even though it didn't have an impact on them the next day, they still carried the guilt.
Do you think America blames the Secret Service for what happened to President Kennedy?
We blame ourselves.
Yeah.
We feel responsible. I mean, we failed to live up to our responsibility of protecting the president on that occasion, and therefore we were guilty. Mm-hmm. And each one of us feels that, felt it at the time, still do today.
Was it hard to go back to work?
Well, that was probably the blessing to me, was the fact that I was very busy and I continuously worked. And I didn't have a problem dealing with the emotionally dealing with the assassination until years later when I was assigned to a desk job and I had too much time to think. And that's when my problems started.
Yeah. We wanted to tell the new agents that join the Secret Service, is there are not many jobs that you can be 100% failure at. But being an agent in the Secret Service who loses a president, you're a failure.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Michael in Fort Worth. Hi, Michael.
Hello. First off, gentlemen, thank you very much for your service.
Thank you.
Is there a single episode or point other than the assassination that stands out foremost in your memories? Thank you.
I'm guessing if service on the Kennedy detail is what he's talking about.
About what?
Service on the Kennedy detail.
Oh, well, we had quite a transition. There was the best job in the world. We had a transition going from President Eisenhower to President Kennedy, and the first thing he wanted to do was to learn your name. And at first, the agents were referred to as the silent service. He said, those guys don't say anything. And he had a special officer that was in the Secret Service that had worked with him by the name of Muggsy O'Leary. And Muggsy told us, you guys better loosen up a little bit. And so after that, once he learned your name, he asked the children's name. He asked the family's name. If he didn't have matters of state on his mind, he'd stop by a post and start chatting with you. And it was just a great, great relationship. You know, no matter how your politics were, he was a tremendous man.
Lisa, I think everybody remembers that iconic shot of little John John saluting the coffin as it went by. And there's a really sweet story explaining in the book how he learned to salute very soon before that time.
Yeah, he they were in Middleburg, where the family had sort of a country house, a weekend house that they stayed at. And Mrs. Kennedy especially loved to spend time there with the horses. And it was the weekend before Veterans Day. And the president had planned to take John to Arlington Cemetery with him for the ceremony. And so Mrs. Kennedy was trying to show him how to salute properly. And then when they went to the ceremony, John saluted his father, but his father didn't see him.
This is the Veterans Day ceremony.
The Veterans Day mm-hmm. ceremony. And then sadly, it turned out that 2 weeks later, you know, there's that iconic photo of him. And prior to coming out of the church, John had gotten very rambunctious, and his agent had sort of taken him aside. And there was a Marine colonel, I believe, that was with him, and they were trying to figure out something to do with him. They said, "Let's practice your salute," because he had been using his left hand. And the colonel said, "Here's how you do it." And so he had practiced it a few moments before, and then when his father's body came out of the church, he saluted properly.
How did the Kennedy assassination change the Secret Service?
Well, we had lunch with the director of the Secret Service and his staff, and Jim Rowley's granddaughter was there, the chief of the director.
This is just last week. Wow.
That time. And his staff, and he said, you know, and this, I don't know whether it's a backhanded comment, but he said, "You were the people that created the change in the Secret Service." We had a budget of about $4.5 million, about $4.5 million, and we had 330 agents or so. 34 agents on the detail. Today, the budget is about $1.4 billion. There are over 3,500 agents, and new technologies, everything that is required. But anybody who's ever served on protection realizes there's always a vulnerability.
The one thing about it, though, is that the numbers changed. From the 269 agents on board when I came into the service in 1958 to the 3,500 that are plus that are there now. But the job hasn't changed that much. And the responsibility is the same, and the commission book still says worthy of trust and confidence.
My guests this hour have been former Secret Service agents Clint Hill and Gerald Blaine, and journalist Lisa McCubbin. Blaine and McCubbin are authors of the new book, The Kennedy Detail, JFK's Secret Service Agents Break Their Silence. It's been wonderful to talk with all three of you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.